From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour has been made in recent years in local emergency departments. Improvements in trauma care have led to better outcomes for people who have been shot. That's also true for victims of stabbings and other violent assaults. Perhaps you saw the recent story in the Democrat and Chronicle by reporter Sean Lehman, who dug into what has changed and why. The roots go back to, of all places, battlefields in Iraq. We're going to get into that coming up. And at the core of this story is a better understanding of what is happening in our community. Sometimes when we talk about violence, we look at basic statistics like the local homicide rate. But with trauma care improving, we have to add more context if we want to fully understand what is happening in Rochester or Buffalo or any community. And later this hour, we're going to have some clips of people who have suffered gunshot wounds in mass shooting events. And if you have questions or you want to share your experience, we'll welcome your phone calls as well this hour. Let me go ahead and welcome my guest. Sean Lehman is a watchdog reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle who did that outstanding story that prompted this conversation. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And Dr. Mark Gestring is here, Director of Adult Trauma at the Kessler Burn and Trauma Center at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Gestring, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Sean, you got a lot that you can work on in this community, and I want to know what first brought you to this story. What put this on your radar?
Well, it's been interesting to me to look at the crime statistics as compared to people's perception of crime, and particularly as it relates to violence. You know, the number of homicides in our community has been falling pretty steadily since the early 1990s, which is a trend that's happened almost every place nationwide. But when I talk to cops on the street, the people who are on the front lines and see this violence, they say it's not really that violence has been reduced, it's that more people who are victims of violence have been surviving. And I looked into some rough numbers on that, and I found that 10 years ago in 2007, about 20% of people who were shot in the city of Rochester died from their injuries. And you know, 10 years later, it was closer to 11%. So the numbers do kind of bear that out, that more people are surviving these very serious injuries.
I find that pretty remarkable. We're talking about cutting it almost in half in a decade. And Dr. Gestring, in specific, you look at the Boys and Girls Club shooting, which I know came up in Sean's article, and I wanted to ask you about that. Go back to August of 2015, a drive-by shooting. There's a large crowd coming out pretty late at night after a basketball game at the Boys and Girls Club on Genesee Street. Seven people were shot. Now, three died, and four more suffered gunshot wounds. And you think all seven could have died, Dr. Gestring?
Well, there's so many intangibles when you look at those kind of events. You know, when you shoot into a large crowd, you can hit two people, you can hit seven, you can hit 25, depending on what kind of gun you're using and the way people are scattered. I think it's absolutely possible all seven could have died. The ones that did come to the hospital were sick. The ones that died, I think, died at the scene. I don't think they came to the hospital of the ones that did die. It's an epidemic in this country. We're seeing it locally in Rochester. These are dangerous situations, and whether, you know, nobody would say you're going to play in the fast lane of a highway, but when you shoot a gun into a crowd, things happen. So I do think that, I think it's highly likely that in a situation like that, people can die. Now, I can't speak specifically to the injuries of the four that didn't die, but I can tell you they were all pretty serious, and you know, we spent quite a bit of time through the trials and things like that talking about those injuries afterwards.
20 or 30 years ago, is it possible or likely that they all would have passed away?
Well, it once again, it's hard to say. It depends very much on what gets hit. We have people who get shot and the bullet passes through superficially and they're out of the hospital within a day. That exact same bullet, a couple of inches over, can hit an important vascular structure or you know, paralyze somebody, and then it changes the trajectory from that point on. It can change a life. So it's very dependent on what gets hit. But when you start shooting lots of bullets into crowds of many people, the formula is quite bad.
And Dr. Gestring, I don't mean to be sort of trite about this or ask a cliche question, but I look at people in your profession. I don't think I could do it. I don't think in that moment where people are coming in with gunshot wounds and a mass shooting, I don't know that I could. Can you characterize what it is like? I mean, are you relying on training? Are you relying on a protocol, a series of events that you know need to happen to save these people?
Well, I made this point during, you know, during the work we did on the article that Sean put together, but this is very much a team sport. So the trauma surgeons are one piece of a much larger team. And it's not even just the hospital team. We were talking before the broadcast, it's the first responders, it's the firemen, it's the EMTs, it's the citizens who are controlling bleeding before the patients get in here. How quickly do they get to the trauma center? When they get to the trauma center, all of the different pieces that have to happen. So by the time I get in there, my job's pretty straightforward because so many people are doing what they need to do. And then the decision about who needs surgery, what kind of surgery, let's get that going. It becomes easier because you're not doing this by yourself. You're doing this as part of a much larger team.
All right, Sean, so as we look at crime in Rochester, first of all, is it too simplistic to say crime is up or down? I mean, how do you view that as a reporter now?
It is. I think it is too simplistic to try to make those singular assessments because crime encompasses a lot of things. And last year, for example, the mayor and the police chief came out and said that crime was at historically low rates, although in some categories, it was up. You know, robberies were up. So it's hard to just say that. That's part of the reason why there's been this ongoing debate, not just locally but nationally, about whether crime is up or not. And that's one of the challenges. And that's why I thought it was important to dig more deeply into this to get a better understanding of when we're talking about to just look at homicides. You know, homicides are relatively rare events. We had 42 in the city last year. I was 36, I think, the year before that. You know, a single incident can move those numbers up or down. When we talk about shootings, you know, we have a couple of hundred people each year shot in the city of Rochester. That's I think, a more accurate way to get at the level of violence.
Yeah, I mean, if you have 40 homicides in one year, then the next year you have 30, you know, you could stand on the corner and say, we have a 25% decline in homicides. Look at how far crime has fallen in a year. Yeah. You're looking at total number of people shot as a more accurate representation.
I think so. When I talk to cops, they say shooting victims and robberies are the two best barometers for really gauging violence and violent acts because those are the two most common violent acts that occur on a regular basis.
If you both could, walk me through how this really got, I don't know if revolutionized the world but is the word, but the change in trauma care that comes with understanding of how quickly a gunshot victim needs to be in front of a surgeon versus field care, you know, all of those things that came into it. It goes back to Iraq, right?
There's always been a very close association between what we learn in war and what translates into the civilian world. A good example is, you know, people who are familiar with MASH, what we learned through Korea and Vietnam about trauma systems and the concept that a soldier shot in a jungle can get better trauma care, you know, in 1965 or 70 than a citizen shot in an urban city. So much of what we learned in those earlier days had to do with the development of trauma systems and how all of this works today. The individual care that we're providing today has learned a significant amount from what's happening in Iraq and Afghanistan. The research that's being done in conjunction with the care that's being provided has helped us modify our resuscitation strategies, the way we're giving blood, the type of blood and the type of blood products that we're giving, the type and degree of surgeries that we're doing initially compared to things that we're doing later. Certainly what we're doing in 2017 has been influenced by what's been happening in our recent military experience. But on a more global sense, you know, war has always driven what we learned about this particular disease.
Interesting. Sean, if you don't mind, I'd like to just read from your story on this section, sure. and we'll talk about it here. This is from Sean Lehman's story. Quote, many of the improvements were prompted by lessons learned on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan, where there was a concerted effort to collect and analyze data about patient outcomes. That research showed that the biggest factor in whether soldiers survived gunshot wounds was how quickly they got to a trauma surgeon. Navy surgeon Richard Janik, an upstate native, wrote about those lessons in his book, On Call in Hell, A Doctor's War Story. He described his frustration at seeing a soldier die because he'd lost too much blood by the time he arrived back at the base hospital. Transport time, particularly in a combat zone, was just too long, so Janik decided he needed to get closer to the fighting. He and his team moved as close to the front as they could during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004, one of the deadliest operations of the Iraq War. It took Fallujah to turn theory into practice and to demonstrate the effectiveness of our approach, Jaddick wrote. He shared those results with other military doctors, as well as those in the private sector. The one that means the most to me and to all those who made it possible is that an estimated 30 Marines who otherwise would have perished in Fallujah were able to make it home to their families, he said. So, you know, in one sense, Dr. Gestring, you think, well, this is obvious. Someone's been shot. You've got to get them to a surgeon. But then you start understanding all the different layers of care, you know, the work in the field, the work that may be happening on the way, and I guess good old gasoline, that was the joke, is the most important thing. So tell me about that.
The most important resuscitation fluid, we say, is diesel.
Is diesel.
It's what runs most ambulances. So trauma centers are these kind of sophisticated places that are set up to provide everything always 24/7. By definition, that's extremely inefficient because you can't. It's very hard to sustain that, which is why trauma centers tend to be in specific areas. Not every hospital has the capability to do this. But the trauma center by itself, it doesn't work unless the patients are quickly transported. So like you said, the rapid transport. So we work very hard with EMS and, you know, all of the components required to quickly recognize that somebody's injured, quickly recognize that this is a life-threatening problem, quickly get them to the hospital, let us know that they're coming before they get there so we can be ready. And when they do arrive, we have surgeons that are physically present. We have operating rooms that are physically ready to go. We have all the equipment that you need to do this. So it's not just enough to have one person standing there who might have the knowledge. You have to have all of those pieces in place. You have to have a blood bank and an ICU and all that kind of stuff. And that's very much what we learned from Iraq. So even though we're not moving our trauma centers deeper into areas where people are injured, the training that we're doing with EMS, you know, simple things, working with the police department to decrease the amount of time before a scene is cleared. So in past days, they would hold the scene until it was definitely safe, and it would be 25 minutes before they let EMS in. We're working with the police department, I think very successfully, to decrease the amount of time where they can get in, get the victim, and get out. So many times the transfer times to the hospital are not long, but what ends up happening is the EMS is held up at the scene for various reasons.
Yeah, and that's tough. I mean, I know officers want to do their work, but the bottom line is that 25 minutes could be too long. It could be the difference, right?
It frequently is, and I think they understand that, and I think we've been working very well together to try and come up with something that's safe for everybody involved and also to maximize the care these patients can get.
Sean, had you heard of Jaddick's book, On Call in Hell, A Doctor's War Story, before you started setting out on this report?
I hadn't, but he wrote this book a number of years ago, but it was fascinating to read after I talked to Dr. Gestring, you know, exactly some of those lessons from the battlefield. Obviously, combat injuries are different than what we typically see on the street here, but I think many of the important lessons from Iraq grew out of the fact that, you know, the soldiers are wearing typically helmets, they're wearing body armor, and so most of the injuries, the survivable injuries that combat medics were seeing were wounds to the extremities, to the arms and the legs, or in the neck, in the groin area. And so my sense is that we learned a lot about treating those types of injuries where I would guess the main issue is the rapid loss of blood. If you get struck by, you know, the femoral artery in the leg, you could die pretty quickly if you don't get that attended to.
And so you had a chance to talk to at least one person, Mr. Hester, who suffered a gunshot wound for the course of your reporting. Can you tell us a little
Isaiah
bit about
that? Hester's a teenager in the city who was shot on the street in broad daylight. He got caught up in an argument between two other people, and he got shot. And talking to him, the thing that he remembered most about that incident wasn't the pain. It wasn't the shock of having been shot. It was about looking down and seeing a hole in his leg and seeing how much blood was coming out. And he had, he had a sense in the moments after he was shot that he was going to die if he didn't get help quickly. And fortunately he did. He happened to be just down the street from an urgent care clinic. A friend helped him in there, and an ambulance had him to Strong Hospital within a matter of minutes.
I found reading his account in your story really sort of dispassionate and rational. I mean, you've just been shot, and you're thinking, well, I'm going to die here if I don't get help. I mean, Dr. Gestring, I guess the reaction of or the setting in of pain is probably different depending on where you get shot, I would imagine, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And your perception of what's going on is also based on where you're shot, because you could easily, if you had a spinal cord injury, you're not going to feel pain, you know, something along those lines. Along what you were just talking about, though, what they learned in Iraq and Afghanistan and what we're practicing in the trauma center is now being translated into civilian training. So the example of the extremity gunshot wounds that Sean just used, we are actively engaged in the kind of national, what's called Stop the Bleed program, which is targeting civilians for training in how to control extremity hemorrhage. And the impetus for that is through the Department of Homeland Security, and it's based on mass shootings and multiple casualty type events. But the reality of for us in Rochester, if you're between exit 45 and 46 on the thruway, you're waiting for help. And if you're on a motorcycle, or if, you know, there's a number of ways you can get injured. And just like Sean said, extremity bleeding really at this state at this time should have a zero mortality. And if somebody knows how to use a tourniquet, has a tourniquet, knows how to use direct pressure, that's life-saving information even before somebody gets to the hospital. So you put direct pressure on a bleeding article, on a bleeding artery, your chance of getting to the hospital with a survivable blood pressure and then to be fixed is much better. So we do a lot training kind of citizens in that regard.
All right, so I think this is important. So a couple things here. First of all, you said extremity bleeding deaths should be zero?
Should be zero, yeah. So, I mean, if you're talking about an arm or a leg, you're talking about arteries that can be controlled externally, you know, whether it's a tourniquet or, you know, something, direct pressure, something like that. Much of what we learned, like Sean said, is because the soldiers in modern battle wear very good body armor. So we're seeing head injuries based on IED explosions. But most of the penetrating things, the torso is pretty much protected because of the degree of armor that they're wearing. But it's the arms and legs that get shot. And even in amputation-type situations, if you can control the bleeding, you can get to a trauma center where it can get fixed.
All right. Now, this is where a listener may have a little bit of tension on the couple of messages we've been hearing, which is, first of all, that diesel is the most important fluid. You got to get there. But that doesn't mean don't dress a wound or don't apply pressure. So make sure we understand, you know, all of those things, how
I mean,
they work together.
I can speak to a case just within the last month where a Rochester police officer was the first on the scene and put a tourniquet on a wound that was clearly life-threatening and was an extremity wound. The patient had been bleeding for a while, and that police officer saved that patient's life. I mean, ultimately, the patient came to the trauma center and required resuscitation in an ICU and needed to have an arterial injury repaired. We did that part. But if a tourniquet wouldn't have been applied at the beginning, the patient would not have gotten to us alive. And we knew that because they arrived at the trauma center with a blood pressure of 50. With the tourniquet on. Had that tourniquet not been on, patient would have died. So that police officer doing what he did at that time saved this patient's life.
Doctor, are all police officers trained in this?
I believe they are. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I assume they are. Yeah.
Yep, and many of them carry. I know in Rochester they carry tourniquets, and we were very ecstatic that this worked very well in this particular case because it's an isolated injury. The problem is clearly apparent, easy to fix. You just have to be alive so that we can fix it.
And do you have a sense for what percentage of extremity injuries, blood injuries, arrive to you with proper tourniquet, with proper dressing?
Prepared? Well, so I want to be careful because not everybody shot in an arm or leg needs a tourniquet.
Okay.
So we do teach and people who, you know how to do this understand what active bleeding is and what arterial bleeding is. And there are certain ways to distinguish that. But somebody with active bleeding, tourniquets are very easy to use. And we see, I can't give you an exact number, but we see, you know, probably maybe two tourniquets a week at the trauma center.
Properly applied.
Properly applied.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so for a listener who's hearing you say, we could get to zero extremity blood deaths if we're doing this right, if we're prepared, if they don't have training or if they want to learn, more on what to do, what's a way to do that?
So the trauma center is very active in the Stop the Bleed training. The course we're teaching is something called Bleeding Control, or BCON course. It's a nationally available product, so that it's very easy to teach. It's very easy to learn. The supplies are easy to come by, and we do this for free all over the place to anybody who wants to, you know, to do it. We've done it for motorcycle clubs, and certainly in our area, you know, hunters, motorcyclists, bicyclists, that kind of audience. We've done it for ski patrols. We've done it for Boy Scout troops. We're going to be doing it for, you know, we've done it for a number of law enforcement groups. It's easy training. It's good review if you think you've already had the training, but it's a good review. And it's a very, the focus is very similar to what they did in Seattle with teaching CPR. You know, and they found that there was less sudden cardiac death when everybody on the corner knew CPR. And it's the same kind of thing. These are basic skills.
Let me ask you a question that's in the category of asking for a friend when it might actually be for myself. What about people who are squeamish? There's not a whole lot you can probably do about that, but we can be trained too.
Absolutely. And I think the extent to which you can get involved, I mean, I think in the past people have felt like if a wound is actively bleeding, stay away. So there's a number of things you can do to minimize the bleeding until help gets there. And there's no expectation that a civilian is going to become a physician overnight with a one-hour course. But there's some basic things that you can do and ideally would do that would keep a patient long enough, keep them stable long enough for real help to get there, whether it's an ambulance or something like that.
Do you get the sense that people who are generally squeamish, you know, it's one thing to see what they would consider unsettling on television, but in real life, you know, you kick into action, you understand what's at stake, you can get over it.
Yeah, and the example was like the Boston Marathon bombing. That's where this training evolved from, where it's kind of the new definition of what we call the immediate responder. We know what first responders are, but the immediate responder is you're standing next to somebody when something bad happens and you're in a position to help and somebody else needs your help. And you're not really thinking about squeamish. You're thinking about, I'm going to use a belt, I'm going to use my shirt, I'm going to do something to stop this bleeding until help gets there. And even though you're surrounded by help, you're also surrounded by victims who need help. So that little bit of time really does make a difference.
What is the best item for a tourniquet if you're doing it in a rudimentary, quick way?
A tourniquet.
Which is made of?
A tourniquet is usually the best. And part of this effort is trying to get tourniquets readily available. So the same way the defibrillators are hanging up in public places, there's bleeding control kits that are marketed and they don't expire and you can easily hang them up in public places so that these things are on the wall in auditoriums and
bleeding control kits?
Bleeding control kits, which consist of tourniquets and special kinds of gauze and things like that. So those, when you're asking me what's the best, that's the best way to do it. But there's all kinds of ways to improvise if you don't have that.
Okay, because I miss a lot of things in my life, of course. I don't know that I've ever seen... Sean, have you seen bleeding control kits?
I have not, no.
Well, so you're going to see a lot more of them if we're doing our job right, because we are working on this very aggressively, trying to get these kits out and about.
I'm asking Megan and Rob, have you guys seen bleeding control kits? Your goal will be to get a lot more of these out there, just as common as like a defibrillator.
Yep, the same way the defibrillators are hanging on the wall in public places, these would be sitting here, same thing.
Okay, but until we get to a point where they are almost ubiquitous, if you can't find one like that, is a belt better than a shirt? You know, I mean, a towel.
Well, so you have to put significant pressure, and the reason tourniquets are so effective is they're designed for you to not only snug up the tourniquet, but then also there's a way to ratchet down even further. So belts are better than nothing, but they don't work as well unless you put some sort of specific tension on it. So usually we tell people if instead of making up your own tourniquet, it's probably better to just put direct pressure. So when you take a shirt or something like that and you push on this thing until help comes.
Okay, so take that shirt or a towel or whatever and use your hand and push.
But this is just kind of one simple example to highlight what you were talking about. Yeah. All of these things were learned. You know, tourniquets, for people who are paying attention, have kind of gone out of phase for the longest time because we were told 15 years ago, we were told they're dangerous, don't use them. And then based on what we learned in Iraq and Afghanistan, every soldier now carries a tourniquet as part of their uniform.
Why was that being said? I don't recall that conversation publicly.
Yeah, so it's they were used improperly and in the wrong situations. But based on what we learned, part of the buddy care that soldiers are learning now, it's part of your uniform to have a tourniquet on your uniform. They wear it usually on their shoulder, and they're trained how to use it. And they're trained how to use it on themselves and also on their partners. So really? this is kind of new over the last 10, 15 years.
All right, remarkable. If you want that kind of training from the trauma center, just call the trauma center?
That's right.
Okay. Is it easy to find online if people look at it? What's the full name of the trauma center?
So it's the Kessler Trauma Center at the University of Rochester. It's 275-8000. Call 275-8000. We'll get you hooked up.
Oh, very cool stuff. A little diversion of the conversation.
Yeah,
this is, no, it's okay because this is just one of the layers, I think, that contributes to a lower percentage of people who have died. If you missed Sean Layman, what he said earlier, in 2007, if I wrote it down correctly, Sean, you found that 20%, roughly 20% of people who suffered gunshot wounds died in Rochester, and now that number is around 11%.
That's right.
It's because Dr. Gestring and his staff and people in the field are doing a lot of remarkable, more efficient, more, you know, sort of better informed work, evidence-informed work. But don't you think, Dr. Gestring, that eventually we all will have a role in that? I mean, citizens have a role in that as well?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, something that we can't stress enough is the role of prevention. I mean, if you don't get shot, that's much easier to fix you. You know, so all of the things that go into preventing that gunshot wound injury to begin with, that's equally as important. I mean, on the scientific side, I think the field is much better at taking care of these problems. We understand shock much more effectively than we did in the past. We understand how to resuscitate from shock much better than we did in the past. And I think we're doing those things much quicker than we did in the past. But ideally, if you can avoid getting shot,
yeah,
you know, so there's a number of things that we kind of look at in that direction. But I think it's certainly something we would like to put ourselves out of this business for sure.
Well, let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back. Andrew and Jonathan, I've got your questions. We will get to those for our guests coming up here. We also want to talk a little bit about what is, I don't know if pet peeve is the right word, but this idea of using the term non-life-threatening injury. People who survive these kind of events can have very difficult lives. And sometimes those in the media, me included, tend to say, well, did you live or did you die? And then everything is sort of the same in each category. And unfortunately, that's not true. Our guests are Sean Layman from the Democrat and Chronicle, who inspired this conversation with his excellent reporting, which hit, when did that story hit, by the way?
A couple of weeks ago.
All right, a couple of weeks ago. And Dr. Mark Gestring is Director of Adult Trauma at the Kessler Burn and Trauma Center at the University of Rochester Medical Center. We're right back. Coming up in our second hour, several local school districts are considering school start times moving back, giving kids, teenagers, yes, but middle schoolers, young kids as well, more time to sleep, more of an opportunity to show up at school mentally refreshed, prepared to take a test or absorb a lesson or give a presentation. But how would it impact intramurals and other school activities? What do doctors say? What do parents say? Join us. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and wanted to tell you that, real briefly here, if this is the kind of programming that matters to you, I don't like the word if, because you probably wouldn't be listening, you know, if you didn't care. I know you care about your community. I hear from people every day, every week. I hear from young people. I hear from recent college grads who say they feel more connected to Rochester, to Western New York, to Monroe County, to the Finger Lakes, because of programs like this. And that means a lot to us. We work very hard on that. We cannot do it without you. We're in the middle of our pledge week. And I want you to call 454-6300 to make a pledge, especially if you're not a member. Most people listening right now are not members. There's tens of thousands of people literally listening right now who have never been members. And this is a great chance for you to change that. It feels so good when you do that. It's almost like a weight lift, or you feel like you're part of a community in a real way. And especially now, I know people have been talking about it in the last 8-10 weeks or so, but especially now, I know you value real journalism and depth of conversation at a time when the media is getting, the reports are getting shorter. Consultants say no one has an attention span. We don't believe that. Why don't you push back against the consultants a little bit? Call 454-6300 or jump on WXXI.org and donate and contribute to our pledge drive. Become a member. Be part of this community. I would love that. It would mean a lot to all of us on the Connection staff. Thank you for listening every day here. We're talking to Sean Layman from the Democrat and Chronicle and Dr. Mark Gestring about Sean's work covering the question of why we see fewer deaths when it comes to gunshot victims, but also trauma victims. And Dr. Gestring, we've been focusing really heavily on gunshot victims, but one of our listeners, Andrew, sent an email and said that wanted to know if people are more likely to survive a stabbing than gunshots. And Andrew adds he suspects the answer is yes, and he knows it's a slightly political question because he is uncomfortable with guns in society, but he wants to know, what does the evidence say about whether, if you're stabbed or shot, if you're more likely to survive?
Well, the lethality has more to do with where the injury is. So if I stab you in the heart or shoot you in the heart, you have a hole in your heart and the chances of dying are pretty high. It might be easier to fix a stab wound to the heart if you can get them to the hospital fast enough, but we see people dying from stab wounds all the time. In general, stab wounds tend to be less less mortal than gunshot wounds. But once again, it's 100% dependent on where you got stabbed.
Okay. I mean, I'm trying to interpret Andrew's question, and I know he's communicated with the program in the past, and his feeling is if you're going to have a mass shooting or a mass stabbing, fewer people are going to die in a mass stabbing. You seem to be saying maybe, and on the whole, fewer people die from stabbings. If there's 100 stabbings and 100 shootings, there's probably fewer deaths from the stabbings, but it's sort of case by case and where the injuries happen.
Right. I mean, if everybody got stabbed in the neck, you're going to have a problem.
Yes. To state the obvious there. Okay. And Sean, you know, you set out to report on this. It wasn't just about gunshot wounds, right?
No, that's right. I mean, obviously, the same kind of advances that are helping people survive gunshot wounds are helping them survive stab wounds, but also, you know, motor vehicle accidents.
Okay. Jonathan writes to the program and wants to know, do doctors see gunshot victims coming in with wounds from more powerful weapons than they saw years ago?
Well, so our trauma center is more rural than sometimes you would think. So we see rifle shots that are usually hunting, and we'll see those from usually outside the Monroe County area. So we definitely have an experience with those type of high velocity type injuries, and those can be pretty significant. But those tend less to be associated with violence and more related to hunting type accidents. What we do see, I can say that. Today's handguns are more sophisticated than handguns in the past. So where you used to have 6 38 caliber bullets, you now have significantly more 45 caliber bullets coming out of a more sophisticated weapon. So I think the guns are more powerful, but we also see more bullets. So it's much easier to shoot 5, 6, 8 bullets than it was in the old days where you'd have to click, click, click. So these things come out much faster. So I think what we see a lot of is complications related to multiple holes and bullets going in multiple different either directions in the same patient or multiple patients because of that, the ease of being able to deliver those bullets.
Okay, so I think if I change Jonathan's question to, are guns more deadly or more dangerous these days?
Well, again, it depends on what you hit. You know, but I think it is easier to... It is easier with today's technology to deliver bigger bullets in a more rapid fashion. So probably I would say yes.
All right. What I want to do is I want to listen to some sound bites we have from a couple different sources from people who survived shootings, both of them in this case in mass shooting situations. And what I want to do is I want to listen to these comments and then hear from the doctor on the panel and then also talk about what it means for survivors and how... I think Sean and I agree on this, you know, and we've all been guilty occasionally of just sort of waving away gunshot victims or stabbing victims as survivors, as if they're all in the same category with the same life outlook ahead. First is the story of a 12-year-old named Mason. Now, Mason was shot in the stomach during a mass shooting in Nevada. He talked to CNN about what happened to him. So first, I want to listen to Mason talking about, you know, sort of the escape from that situation and what went on with him.
After I was shot, I tried to go back in the building, and then I ran away from him, and there was another entrance on the end of South Hall, and I tried to go, and then but it was locked, so I went to Agri's Grizzly, and there was a secret security that helped me, told me to lay down and put pressure on my wound.
So he laid down and put pressure on his wound. And, you know, doctor, I know obviously you don't know that case in particular. He had been shot in the stomach but was able to move around. So number one, does that mean likely he wasn't hit in a major organ at that point?
Well, I think the one thing you could say is he wasn't hit in the spine. And we see that quite often, those bullets. If they go through the spine, you're not moving. Depending on the level of the spine, you're not moving your legs or your arms. So I can say, just based on the little bit that I heard, that he was not hit in his spine. But certainly, you can get shot in the liver, spleen, stomach, and still be able to move around.
Okay. He was told to lay down and put pressure on the wound. Yes? Lay down? Is laying down a smart thing to do there?
Well, so yeah. If you're in a safe place to lay down, makes sense. But I think once you're talking about central injuries, which involve the chest and abdomen, the quicker you can get the surgical help, the better. External pressure is not likely to help an internal bleed,
okay,
which is different from what we just finished talking about with arms and legs, where okay, that thing is, where those are life-saving, you know, those type of maneuvers. But when you're talking about chest, abdomen, pelvis, those kinds of wounds, the quicker you can get to a surgeon, the better.
They did say in the report that this was one of those 1 inch in one direction or 1 inch in another direction situations, and he was very fortunate. But what Dr. Gestring is reminding us is that one of the reasons we've seen such better trauma care in recent years is the idea that is being applied much more commonly to just get it to a surgeon, get the patient to a surgeon. And so Mason also deserves to have us play his next comment, because the reason this 12-year-old was willing to talk to CNN is that he and his family wanted to say something to other kids and all of us about guns. This is Mason.
I used to treat guns not poorly, but a little poorly, because I thought they were a toy. But when I got shot, I learned that they're not just a toy. They're a weapon, and they could damage somebody very bad.
So Mason wanted to make sure people heard that. And in this case, once again, he was a victim in a mass shooting. He wasn't playing with a gun or thought it was a toy and it went off. But Dr. Gestring, how often do you encounter people who were just sort of fooling around, that this wasn't someone shooting another intentionally?
So we don't see that very often. The unintentional type shootings, I would say that I see more often, is somebody with an illegal weapon who should not be carrying that weapon, who's taking that weapon out of their belt, for instance, or out of their pants, either to use it or to show it, and in the process it goes off. So it's an unintentional shooting, which is really preventable. Certainly there's national attention to stories when a kid finds an unsecured weapon. And
yeah.
Thankfully, we don't see that very often. But there's some regularity to how often we see the self-inflicted shootings, which are not proper holsters, not properly carried, shouldn't even be having them, taking a loaded gun out and shooting yourself in the leg or the crotch or something along those lines, which is related to just taking the gun out of where you're holding it.
Okay. How often do you see that?
More so than you would think. I would say I've seen that probably 5 times in the last 6 months.
Wow. So just about every month someone's coming in.
Well,
with that.
I mean, that's okay. My own personal observation.
Sure.
But yeah, I think it's always funny because that's never the story that you hear.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a different story. But then when you figure out somebody's right-handed and you figure out draw a line between where the gun must have been and where the bullet is, it makes a lot more sense.
All right, and let's listen to what Mindy Finkelstein had to say. She had a conversation with BuzzFeed News, which is why you'll hear a little bit of produced-up sort of sound here. But thanks to Wikipedia, this is just the background on the shooting that Mindy was a victim in. It's the 1999 Los Angeles Jewish Community Center shooting. That was August 10th, 1999. A white supremacist by the name of Buford Furrow Jr. walked into the lobby of the North Valley Jewish Community Center and opened fire with a semi-automatic weapon. He fired 70 shots into the complex. The gunfire wounded 5 people. 3 were children. 1 was a teenage counselor, that's Mindy, and 1 was an office worker. And shortly thereafter, he shot and killed a mail carrier, fled the state, and finally was arrested. So that was back in 1999. This is what Mindy says she remembers about being 16 years old and trying to understand what was happening when she had been shot.
To this day, I still have quite a bit of shrapnel inside my leg, and it's a constant reminder of what I went through. The thing that I remember most is when you breathe in, you feel air inside your lungs, but you've never felt air anywhere else inside your body. And immediately after the bullets passed through me, I remember feeling invisible because there was air running through me that I had never felt before. And that's the instant that I knew something, A, wasn't right, B, I had been shot, and the moment where I started thinking about death.
She had been shot multiple times in the leg, and she was feeling air pass through. Is that something you've heard before, doctor? Interesting.
No.
But every person's experience is different there. In her case, they rushed her very quickly, as I understand it, to get medical care. Multiple gunshots in the leg, but again, could be a case where, if you're hit in just what you would call the tissue or the muscle, different than an artery.
That's correct.
It's arteries in the ephemeral artery or in the leg. What's the biggest concern in the leg?
Well, so there's the artery. That's the most life-threatening thing, but there's also bones. I mean, if you get shot through the femur and your bone's broken, you're going to be limited in terms of how you can get out of the situation you're in. So your mobility is going to be interfered with by that. But the life-threatening problem is in the artery and vein.
She's talking about still having shrapnel in her body. Is that common?
Yep, absolutely. We don't usually chase after the metal because you can do more damage to tissue trying to get it out. We do chase it if it's in a very dangerous spot, like in the spinal cord or near the spinal cord. But most other places we'll leave it be.
I guess I'm super ignorant here. I'm a little surprised at that only because I My first super ignorant question is, could that cause infection?
Not usually. Not usually. The body treats it very much like a splinter. So depending, like if, you know, when we see it in arms, legs, backs, things like that, it'll come to the surface and eventually you can take it out 6 months later. It comes out on its own.
The bullet or the fragment works its way to the surface.
Yeah, very much like a splinter. We'll go after them if they're in a bad spot. But many times we end up fixing the injury and not chasing the metal.
Now, this gets us to the question of non-life-threatening injuries or survivors. You just heard from two of them. One of them, you know, still has fragments in her body 16 years later, says she still has pain. I'm sure that's possible, right? I mean, depending on the injury, you can have pain.
Absolutely.
Some people could have pain the rest of their lives, right? And does it bother you, Dr. Gestring, that the media, again, me included, sometimes says, well, non-life-threatening injuries, or we kind of say, how many people died? How many people didn't?
You know, it gets to what you started the program off with. You know, there's way more than just life and death. Certainly, that's an important component of it. But I can tell you, I'm taking care of somebody right now who's in their third month of hospitalization. And when they leave the trauma center, they're going to be paralyzed. This is a life-changing event. And this is somebody who, you know, on the night they were shot, it was a non-life-threatening injury, transported to the hospital. So, you know, so that statement does not properly reflect the change in this person's life, the change in this family life, and, you know, what happened on that particular day.
But they'll just be listed as a survivor in some statistics.
And that's correct.
Along with someone who got a bullet graze in the arm and didn't even spend an overnight in the hospital.
Well, now that Sean has brought attention to this issue, I hope that's no longer the case.
Well, and that's, frankly, that's one of the reasons why we started talking to gunshot survivors, because I think we recognize that, you know, a lot of attention gets paid to the people who die, and rightly so. And the coverage is prolonged by the fact that there's, you know, hopefully an arrest and a trial of the perpetrator. But that we don't pay that much attention to these gunshot victims. And in talking to many of them, as I have along with my colleagues over recent months, it really is startling to see the tremendous burden that some of these people carry going forward, and not just folks who are paralyzed, but people, you know, even somebody like Isaiah Hester, who we spoke to, a relatively, in the scheme of things, minor gunshot wound. He was out of the hospital within a few days, but he had prolonged physical therapy that he had to go to. He said when he left the hospital, he couldn't walk. And, you know, beyond just the length of care that he needed, you know, there's the psychological trauma that weighs not just on him, but on his friends and on his family, who have to, you know, have to live with this.
When you talk to people who have suffered these kind of wounds, Sean, you know, do you find yourself, do they feel the frustration that people around them think, well, aren't you happy you survived, as opposed to trying to understand how their lives may have changed?
I do hear that from them, and particularly even people who have very good outcomes. I've heard from a number of victims who say, you know, people around them say, well, it wasn't that big a deal because you look fine now, a year later or 18 months later. Without really recognizing the difficult path that they've had to go through and the ongoing issues that they may still have.
And I can tell you from the physician side, I spend a good amount of time in court, and these things come to trial, like Sean just said, 6 months, 8 months, a year later, and the victim is now talking to a jury about what they went through, and they look just fine 6 months, 8 months, a year later. But they did not look fine when they were first shot, and they did not look fine for the first 3-5 months of the recovery. So it's part of our job is to make the point that, no, this was a serious injury. This patient probably could have died had it not been for the care that they got. And the crime that was committed 6 months ago, 8 months ago, was a real crime, and that needs to be considered. This is not a trivial thing. You know, and it's one of my pet peeves, because myself and my partners put a lot of effort into keeping these people alive, and then 6 months later, you know, the criminals say, well, the patient looks fine. No problem.
Yeah, right.
And that's not correct.
Do you try to, I mean, you have to answer the questions you're given on the stand, doctor, but I mean, is that emphasis tried, you know,
well,
is
no,
that an important
I think,
emphasis?
I think the legal system, the prosecutors particularly, make a good effort to reflect based on medical records and other testimony how serious the injury was. But sometimes you're looking at a patient who looks just plain fine. So it's, you know, so you really have to spend some time making that point to say this was a life-threatening problem 6 months ago or a year ago.
I read Andrew's email earlier and got a couple of comments just about guns in general. Mm-hmm. And the goal of, you know, removing gun violence is something that everybody has, even if you're on different political sides. I mean, nobody wants to see gun violence. But Sean Lehman, what else are you working on in your own reporting when it comes to guns in our community? This is a good chance to kind of talk about that.
Yeah, well, I'm working on a story that'll run later this week or perhaps this weekend about the new gun court, which is one of the programs that really grew out of the aftermath of the Genesee Street Boys and Girls Club shooting, and the sense that we need to do more to help get guns off the street. This is a program that tries to put all of the gun possession charges in front of a single judge, so that there's consistency with the way that those cases are handled. These are not violent cases. These are cases where the primary charge or the top charge against a defendant is just a gun possession charge. And the hope is that by being more aggressive in going after those folks who have guns illegally, that they can help to take those off the street. And that in cases where there are, you know, I sat in gun court this week, there are 24 cases on the docket, and a lot of them were, most of them, frankly, were young men, 16 to 19, and some of whom will say, you know, look, I have not used the gun. I'm carrying it because I live in a very unsafe neighborhood, and I feel like I need it for my own personal safety. And it's an opportunity on the other end of the spectrum to try to prevent some of this gun violence before it happens. If you talk to police, as I have, you know, the problem we have with gun violence here is not street gangs battling over territory. It's not drug dealers. Most of the gun violence that we see comes down to interpersonal disputes between two people over stuff that seems trivial, frankly, when you hear the story. People are arguing over a comment that was posted on Facebook, and it escalates to gun violence. And so the thought is, if you can get the guns out of the hands of some of these young people so they don't have them when these incidents rise up, then obviously it's less likely they're going to be used.
Where is gun court located, by the way?
It's in the courthouse. It's Judge Moran and Judge Schiano, now two judges who are hearing these cases, just in a regular courtroom. But it's just they've made an effort to put all of these cases before a single judge, mm-hmm. so that there's some consistency in the way they're heard.
Yeah, and I forgive me again if you mention it. How long have they been doing this, Sean?
It started November of 2015, so it's been about 14 months.
Okay, really, just a couple of months after the Genesee.
That's right.
The shooting outside the Boys and Girls Club.
And it's based on something that some other cities have done, but they got some grant money to try to do this, and it seems to be paying dividends from what I hear. I know that by most measures, violence in the city was down last year. Fewer shooting victims, fewer aggravated assaults, and the number of gun arrests was up. So
I also just want to mention one other quick point before the hour is up here. When we talk about the term mass shooting, different news organizations actually use different terms with this. Mother Jones did a pretty big report on this last year. And I would not want anyone to think that I'm minimizing an event like, as Sean just mentioned, let's say there's a house party in Rochester, there's an interpersonal dispute over something. Well, I mean, it doesn't matter what it is. But someone pulls a gun and starts shooting, and there's a few people at the party, and let's say three people are shot. I mean, that is a mass shooting, of course. I mean, that's absolutely horrible, serious event. I do think that that is different categorically than someone who shows up at a public setting just for the purpose of inflicting that, a movie theater, sure, a school, those kind of things. And Mother Jones simply pointed out that, the context does matter, but it doesn't mean that gun violence is not important or dangerous. I mean, Doctor, does it matter to you how we categorize? I mean, you're receiving the victims either way, I guess, right?
No, I think what you said is correct. But at the same time, the scenario where you'll see two people shot in the same incident, or sometimes three or four, you know, once you get into the 4, 5, 6 range, then it really people start to pay attention. But it's not uncommon. Two or three people will get stabbed in the same event, come in at the same time, and those are resources, and this is a timely process to figure it all out, and certainly stresses the system.
It's a whole other conversation to ask ourselves, what does it mean that we've gotten to a point where, as the doctor just said, if it's 5 or 6 people shot in an incident, then more of us will pay attention. But, you know, if it's 3 or 4, that's not all that uncommon. and that we find a way just to not even talk about it. It's just, that's a whole other conversation. But Dr. Gestring, thanks for your time, and thanks for reminding our community, by the way, about how we all can get trained. So one more time, if people want to get their own kind of training on tourniquet work.
So the Stop the Bleed program, we're teaching something called bleeding control, and if you're interested in learning more, 275-8000 is the number for the Trauma Center. There's an education, you can get to the education section there. It's 275-8000. We'll be happy to work with you to get this training to your folks.
How long does the training take?
Usually about an hour, hour and a half.
Boy, and can change and can save a life.
Absolutely.
No question. Thank you for the work that you do in this community. Remarkable stuff from Dr. Gestring. And Sean Lehman, thanks for bringing it to our attention as we to have a better and more contextual understanding of what's going on in our community. Sean from the Democrat and Chronicle. Our thanks to the whole staff here. We're going to get our only break here and come right back with more connections. Next, we're talking about school start times. It's Democrat and Chronicle Day. Justin Murphy did a great job reporting on school start times, and we're going to be talking about what is appropriate. What does the medical community say, and what are schools doing? That's next.